Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. This is Genuinely Grace, and what a week. And I don't know if you can hear, as I'm recording this, you can actually potentially hear the rain. And after last week, when the weather was just like so amazing, it is bucketing down still. It's good for the earth. I hope you've had a good week. We've had a really fun week in the Sober Club. We've had some great sessions and catching up stuff, and lots of things have been going on. And so I'm really delighted to bring you my guest today, who is Rhianne Kivitz, who is a one-of-a-kind love alchemist. That's the title. I love that name. But she, you know, she's also a relate counsellor. She does both the spiritual and the very practical when it comes to relationships. And she did a wonderful, wonderful Q&A for us in the Sober Club, which was just an amazing opportunity for, you know, some of our members to get their questions answered. It's something we love, you know, doing when we can. If we can bring in experts and you can really get your own questions answered, it can just really, really help. Anyways, I did an interview with Rhianne, of course, and so I'm going to be bringing you that in a little while. It's a real thing. You know, last week on the podcast, we were talking about navigating loneliness. I got a really good response to that. So thank you to those of you who really enjoyed that podcast. And you know, certainly navigating relationships after you've stopped drinking can be, you know, can be interesting. you know, so many of our relationships are built on our drinking. You know, we meet someone while we're drinking, we pluck up the courage to speak to them while we're drinking, you know, and on it goes. And everything is based around it in so many relationships. And then when, you know, one person decides they're not drinking anymore, it can feel almost like grief for the person left behind, in inverted commas. And that's just those relationships. Of course, there are many others with parents, with children, with adult children. It's and our friends. It goes on. And constantly I meet people who they're starting to feel good in their sobriety. You know, I have one client who's really starting to get that sense of getting her mojo back. You know, it's happening. She's 4 or 5 weeks in and she's starting to feel better and she's starting to sleep better. And she's you can just sense the excitement. It's a little bit like talking to a different person to the one I spoke with at the very beginning. But there's a nervousness. There's a real trepidation about lockdown ending properly, and that need to be out socializing with a group of friends who everything they ever do is based around booze. So of course all the conversations that are going back and forth are, oh, can't wait till we can, you know, get drunk together again. And just, it's a lot of it is just the not knowing how will I handle this, what will they think of me. It can be just so I don't know, it's kind of debilitating to be stressing about that all the time. And we've all been through it. You know, we really have. The good news is that it gets so much better with time. And the stronger you get, you know, I call it sort of fitting into your sober shoes. And the more you slip your toes in and you really feel that fit in your sober shoes, the more authentic you feel, the more solid, really, the more confident in what you're choosing to do. And when you feel confident, when you go into the conversations and the social situations knowing exactly who you are and with that sense of confidence, then there isn't really very much anyone can say. Even if they try ribbing you a bit, so what? You know, it doesn't matter any more than it would make a difference if, you know, someone who was vegetarian rocked up at a barbecue. And, you know, it just doesn't matter, does it? What difference does it make what you're actually putting in your mouth, right? Anyway, so I'm really looking forward to bringing you the interview with Rhianne. She's just a great expert And a lovely soothing voice as well. So I think you love that. I love the interview. Just before we get into that, just a reminder that I have my Sober by the Sea events finally up and running. So if you go to thesoberclub.com and click on events, you can find that there. They're very low key, tiny, intimate little affairs. I think the first one is sold out now, but there's another one at the end of July, which still has a space, I think, two spaces. And then we'll put some more dates on. And if you're interested in one-to-one coaching in a kind of a one-day intensive in Essex, then that's also something that I'm offering. Because I don't think everyone wants to span this out, you know, over a few weeks. Some people just like to just do that intensive and really deep dive into what's going on for them, whatever stage you're at, of course. Don't forget, I very much, base my work for people who are, you know, sometimes 3 years sober. It really doesn't matter. You might be on day one. You might be sober curious listening to this and wondering, oh, I'm not sure. Or you might have been sober for years, but now you're really starting to focus on what you want for your life. And that's what these days are about. And a lot of the coaching I'm doing ends up not being really very much about drinking at all. It usually ends up being very much about what's next. You know, how can we get that solid base in terms of great nutrition, which of course is massively important if your brain chemistry is out of whack. So the great nutrition in place, the finding your purpose, really being clear on what it is you want, and that whole mindset piece, you know, just sort of helping people recognize that you might have 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 thoughts a day, many of which are negative and unwanted, but you can tame them. You know, you can take control back and raise your vibration. That sounds very woo-woo, but I do really believe it's the truth. You know, we can raise our vibration, and right now it feels super important to do that, actually, because there's a lot of fear around. You don't need me to tell you that, including this ridiculous scaremongering piece that was put out in the week in the press by the World Health Organization. They're suggesting that women of childbearing age, so, you know, everyone from around, I don't know, 17 or something, to the age of about 50, should be banned from drinking alcohol. This was the piece that appeared in much of the press. It's a global alcohol action plan, apparently, and they're calling on countries to raise awareness of the harm of alcohol. I don't know where I stand on this. Of course, I'm interested in anything that looks at the harm that alcohol does. We really need that. We really do, because not enough is looked at on that front. We have these ridiculous limits, you know, these all 14 units is absolutely fine. Well, I don't think it is fine, and no one stops at 14 units anyway. So we have all that nonsense going on. We have constant advertising. We're bombarded with marketing around booze. You know, it's the done thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, I am absolutely against this ridiculous idea that women should be banned from drinking. I mean, what an unbelievably stupid, divisive prohibition. Utterly crazy. I absolutely don't buy it for one second. And I don't think it comes from a place of trying to care for people's health at all. I find it really worrying. Far better if they really cared about our health to be looking at, okay, well, how do we, let's look at the alcohol industry for starters, let's look at government guidelines, let's look at alcohol services, let's look at how GPs and medical professionals are trained so that they recognise that there are, you know, grey area drinkers, so that we know how to inspire people towards a better life without alcohol. Not just telling women. I mean, why just women? You know, men are involved in fertility as well, if that's the point they're trying to make. Utterly ridiculous. Just utterly crazy. So despite the fact that I am not a fan of alcohol in any way, and yes, I would love to encourage and inspire women and everyone to choose to be alcohol free, I am utterly and completely against the idea of trying to ban people from drinking. It's utterly crazy. And I don't think it sparks the right discussions. It just makes people really cross. And then they look at the work that I do and they just get really cross and think, oh, you're another one of those. Well, absolutely not. You know, the title of my book is Happy, Healthy, Sober. It's a choice. It's absolutely your choice. But unless a few people, you know, share with you just how great it is, how are you going to know? Right. So anyways, I think most of you know that's what I do with the Sober Club. It's a platform for inspiring and encouraging and educating and raising awareness about how great life is without the booze and how much more you can, you know, benefit from improving every aspect of your life if you choose not to drink, you know, or some people choose to drink mindfully and that's their choice too. But goodness, if I'd thought that I was, you know, in all the years I was drinking, if I thought that some global action plan had banned me from drinking because I was of childbearing age, I mean, that would have just made me, well, A, decide not to have children, and B, get absolutely hammered the whole time. So totally counterproductive. Anyways, check out thesoberclub.com if you're interested in being inspired to make a choice, not to be shouted at. It's super important to me to have that non-judgmental approach. How else are we gonna get there? Let's hear from our guest. Our topic is one that affects us all, relationships. And Rhianne Kivitz is a one-of-a-kind love alchemist. I love that title, Rhianne, who helps women heal from heartbreak, narcissistic abuse and toxic relationship trauma so they can find real love and embrace their life purpose. And we're going to look at just, well, as much as we can, really, in the short time we've got, Rhianne, around relationships. So welcome. I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much, Janie. And when you invited me to be a guest, I was delighted because I haven't had a drink since September 2019.
Wow, brilliant. Brilliant.
So this really resonates for me.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, I invited you to do this, nothing to do with whether or not you were sober. I just thought it would be great to, right. You know, but of course, that's absolutely icing on the cake because you've kind of been there, done it, got the T-shirt then. So I appreciate that. So just before we get into, you know, some of the questions that I want to kind of throw at you, just tell us a little bit about, you know, your story, what got you into this work, the kind of work you do, because I know that you are, you know, as well as being a love alchemist, which sounds marvelously woo-woo, you know, you're also a relate qualified sex and relationship therapist. And, you know, so you've got the T-shirt, as it were. So just tell us a little bit about your background and maybe a little bit about your story, how you got into doing this work.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess it starts something like 15 years ago. And at that point, I was in an incredibly unpleasant, abusive marriage. And I felt completely trapped. I was living in the city. I was working in jobs that made me feel completely disconnected and uninspired. And I really didn't know anything at all about self-care or self-love or how to look after myself, how to assert my boundaries, how to communicate. And it got to the point, things got so bad that eventually I knew that I had to leave to save myself. And it wasn't that I thought at the time that my partner was going to kill me or anything like that. I actually felt like I was just completely losing myself. Mm. And had no sense of who I was anymore in that relationship. Mm. And I suppose at that point, what you could say is that I had a bit of spiritual awakening. So that's where the woo-woo bit comes in. And I started to look for ways to reconnect with myself. And that's when I came across this concept of the sacred feminine or the divine feminine, as some people call it. And I started to dive deep into modalities like Reiki and crystal healing and meditation. And the more I dove into those subjects, the more it became clear to me that the problem wasn't just that one relationship, that I had actually had a string of unpleasant relationships. Yeah. And although, of course, I wasn't to blame, I was the common denominator there.
Yeah, you took yourself into each one, right?
Right, absolutely. Mm. And as I became more self-aware, what I also realized was that I was actually set up for this in childhood because of the experiences that I'd had right from day one, right from being born. And so at that point, I knew that I actually needed a deeper psychological insight into what was going on with me. And by then I was out of that relationship and I was living independently, and I'd moved well away into Somerset, actually, to Glastonbury. And I decided that I was going to qualify with Relate. Now, at the time, I had this idea that I was doing this because I was so passionate about helping people heal their relationships. But of course, there was a personal motivation in there as well. And it wasn't perhaps as clear to me as it is today, you know, at that time. I can remember at one point in one lecture with one of the tutors, approaching the tutor afterwards and saying to her, "What does it mean if you can't remember huge chunks of your childhood?" And she actually handled it very sensitively and in a very caring way. But of course, I had disassociated and blocked out some parts of my childhood. And at that point, when I started training, I had no idea how relevant all of that stuff really was. Mm. And so I qualified with Relate and started working with couples and individuals. And then I qualified in sex therapy because that was a huge interest of mine. Again, that went back to some of my core issues. And funnily enough, one of the things that I used to do, particularly in that relationship and in relationships previously, was that I used to need to drink in order to be intimate, in order to have sex. Mm. And so, you know, I had some real sexual wounds there that needed to be addressed. And so I worked with Relate. I qualified with them in 2012. And since then, I have been working for myself in this wonderful business, which is really a combination of all my passions.
Yeah.
And the deeper I go on my own journey, the more I learn. So, for example, I bring in the healing side, the holistic healing side to my work. I bring in the psychological awareness. I bring in the divine feminine spirituality. And I bring in modalities like breath work to help release the trauma and to help downregulate the nervous system. Mm.
Yeah, I love it. And just to touch on the, you know, the trauma piece briefly, it's something that listeners to my podcast, you know, will have heard me talk about quite a lot, because, mm-hmm. you know, whenever I work one-to-one with clients, we look at the ACE study, you know, the adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found, well, really fascinating, you know, when I first started looking into all of that work, and a lot of people are talking about it now, of course, because Gabor Mate has got the trauma movie out at the moment. He's doing amazing work. Oh, man, I'd love to get him on the podcast if anyone has got a hotline. Anyways, but, you know, when I first looked into that work, I was absolutely amazed to see that some of the questions on that ACE quiz, in inverted commas, there's only about 10 of them. But one might think that if you're going to use the word trauma linked to childhood, that that has to mean really, really big stuff that anyone would class as trauma, you know, sexual abuse, that kind of thing. But actually, some of the questions are much more innocuous. And I found that really fascinating. I would have said, well, I don't think that I had trauma. I wasn't sexually abused as a child, but I still scored 7, right, mm-hmm. out of 10. You know, due to the fact that, you know, I had one parent with severe mental illness and, you know, lots of very interesting factors that I just don't think many people realize that much of what's going on is trauma from childhood, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where I'm going with the question. I just think it's a fascinating topic. But you know, where do people go with that? You know, my kind of take on it is always, well, you know, we can't then go back and say, okay, so it's your fault, parents or carers, it's all your fault. You know? Now I'm just going to wallow in this because it's all your fault. I mean, I'm guessing you would agree that once we've recognized this, we've acknowledged it, we've looked at it, it becomes our responsibility to be able to heal it then.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, one thing that a lot of people ask me is why? Why did it happen?
Yeah.
You know, wanting a reason for the issues, and that there's a lot of questioning around that, and it gets people stuck at that point. You know, what do I do with it and why? If I knew why, it would be all right. And one of the things that I say is, you know, not to spiritually bypass it, but perhaps sometimes these things happen just as an invitation for us to rise and heal. And when we can't answer that question as to why, then this to me seems like the best approach to take. We know what happened. We accept and understand that it may not in all cases have been our parents' intention to damage us. It was simply that perhaps they were damaged people damaging their children.
Exactly.
And so therefore we can't get stuck in that blame, because all that we do then is become angry, toxic people ourselves.
Yeah.
What we really have to do is to say, well, we know this, and this is empowering information. It really means that the power is in our hands to make a change, and to rise up and to take responsibility, as you say. And I think that can be difficult for some people because they want to blame someone else.
Yes. And also sometimes we want to fill the gap, don't we? And I know in my own case, I entered into completely the wrong relationship. I can now see why, because I needed a father figure. You know, I hadn't really properly had that. So that's what I needed. And that sure is what I got. But super unhelpful and just awful place to be for way too many years. So what is it? Is that something that you see a lot, that people look in their relationship for what they missed out on as a child for perhaps all the wrong reasons?
Well, yes. You know, there's an incredible theory that we think we're drawn into relationships because they're going to heal us, because this person is going to be good for me, you know. But actually, this theory suggests that we're drawn into these relationships because they are familiar to us.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen is that our unmet needs are going to be more obvious to us than ever. Now, what draws us to those people within that, in terms of the familiarity, is that perhaps the behavior patterns are very similar to the patterns we observed in our parents, in terms of the relationships between the parents or caregivers, or the relationships that those parents or caregivers had with us.
Yeah.
And the child always has hope. You know, this is something about little children, right? There's always a sense that there's a glimmer of hope within most children. And so what happens is that glimmer of hope becomes sparked within us when we see this familiarity in the other person, and we're drawn to them like a moth to a flame. But then we get into that relationship and we find that all those unmet needs are being exposed again. And it's like a Groundhog Day, where we find ourselves feeling disconnected, not cared for, not heard, yada, 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 you know?
And I'm guessing, you know, I know we're sort of skipping ahead here, but I'm guessing that you would say that, you know, one of the keys here is to recognize that we have to love ourselves first. You know, we do need that self-acceptance first as that foundation, really, before we can properly expect. You know, we can never expect someone else to make us whole, but we do need to start with looking after ourselves first.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And self-love is a huge part of what I do and what I teach. And it's really not a fluffy subject. I know a lot of people, especially, you know, on the internet, what you see is a lot of very fluffy memes and sweet quotes about self-love. But it's very, very important. However, coming to that place where you know that you love and accept yourself perhaps isn't quite enough, because in my experience there is nothing like having the training ground of relating to actually consolidate that self-love. And almost to prove to yourself that you have changed and that you have shifted. Because it's all very well going into the boundaries and the self-care and having all the principles there in place, but when you are faced with another person once again, you have to be able to step up and implement. It's really like any other skill. I guess it's like, it's like learning woodwork. You can get the theory, but if you don't have the practice, you can't make a cupboard.
Yes. And I guess a lot of it comes to down to communication, doesn't it? Because often when relationships do go wrong, I've heard lawyers talk about this. I've heard, marriage lawyers, and they say, there was one lawyer, and I always remember this quote. So I remember her being interviewed and talking about couples breaking up. And I remember hearing her say, the most common thing that she hears is in her case, she was saying it's women complaining that he wouldn't put the top on the milk or something like that, something seemingly insignificant, right? But then you wonder whether she'd ever express that, just how annoying it was. I mean, I'm being flippant, but you know the point I'm trying to make. We're not very good at, we don't learn how to communicate our feelings and how to properly negotiate, I don't think.
It's true, but one other thing is that we don't necessarily learn how to have a dialogue with ourselves.
Yes.
So how can we communicate with another person if we don't know, like, and trust ourselves in the beginning? Yeah. And so what we have to do is we have to learn how to connect with ourselves, how to listen to ourselves, how to become more sensitive to our body's messages, our mind and soul's messages, and to be able to anchor ourselves in those, because those are our truth and, that those represent our core values, right? Then when we're communicating with another person, we know exactly where we are starting from, and we are then able to communicate clearly. But when people have been through trauma or heartache or abuse, what happens is we tend to disconnect with ourselves. Trauma takes us out.
Yeah.
And so we're disconnected, and we may even be numb. So we can't even feel into our gut, our intuitive sense, and discern what we would like or what we would want. And so we can end up being dragged along by a partner's wants, needs, and desires, thinking that if we're pleasing them, it's okay. And that's another childhood pattern.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yes, communication is key.
And then, of course, when people stop drinking, of course, then, this is when all the dynamics shift and shape all over again, right?
Yes.
And, I've seen it over and over. People just, they change. You change when you ditch the booze, right? Many people do become more aware of their own emotions, finally. And they do in many cases start to recognize the importance of some kind of self-care, and they start to get back their self-esteem. And of course that can then shine a massive light on what is or isn't working in the relationship. So I just wonder what your suggestions might be. I know it's a massive topic, but I did actually have someone email me, just saying, that she has stopped drinking, but her partner hasn't. And this is not someone whose partner wants them to drink, but nevertheless, they fully expect them to go out and socialize and drink with friends and family and be down the pub and go to bed late and all of this stuff. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because from the perspective of the partner who hasn't stopped drinking, it's almost like, well, why are you changing everything? Why are you becoming a different person? We were fine as we were. You were my drinking buddy, right? Mm. It's such a difficult dynamic. I wonder what you would say for someone in that position who is just actually really now even starting to wonder, how are we going to make it through now? What can I do? Because I can't be that old person that I was anymore.
Yeah. I've met couples in this situation in the therapy room, and it's really, really tough. And I think the tough thing is that when one of you stops drinking and starts to develop that self-awareness and really starts to sense that clarity again, other wants and needs and desires come up, you know. And so yes. There is this conflict, and there is this sense really that we might not be so attuned to each other anymore. But it takes two to tango in a relationship. And so it isn't up to the one who's more self-aware to always adapt and to try and accommodate. Because eventually what you're going to do is you're going to push all, again, it's unmet needs, you know, all those unmet needs within. And you are going to find that you no longer feel so connected to your partner. And so talking is very important, assuming they are not drinking all day, every day, 24/7, you know, catching them in the right moment to instigate some proper conversation about this. Yeah. How are we going to manage this? There is now a difference between us. And maybe for some, that's okay. And there will be a difference. But let's talk about how we're going to manage this and the impact that this difference has upon us and our relationship. I don't believe it means that it's the end of the relationship, although I will say that sometimes it can hail the end of the relationship, particularly if the partner who has chosen to continue drinking has some kind of, you know, underlying issues that are driving them to keep seeking distraction in the alcohol. There's also a sense, of course, that there are people who are very attached to their social lives and their idea of that, what they say is their idea of fun. But I think it's very clear that there are other ways to have fun and that there are other ways to socialize.
Yeah.
And so for the partner who's not drinking, it might be important for he or she to say, look, there are some other things I'd like to do. I still want to have fun and I still want to spend time with you, but it doesn't have to be like this all the time. You know, we could go off and do other things. We could develop other interests, and to invite the other person into that, to see if that would perhaps, you know, call them into your world.
Yeah, and I guess a similar thing applies to, you know, it may not be a romantic partner, you know, it might be your family, close family members or friends. The same thing applies in a way, doesn't it? Making other suggestions as to what you can do together.
But the
important thing is being solid in your decision for what you're doing. Right.
Well, I agree, and it's about saying, look, this is what I need to do for me right now. So I'm super grateful that I'm able to tell you that so that you can understand. And can you support me, please, in what I'm trying to do for me? I mean, I went through this when I gave up sugar.
You know, what do you mean you're not having a dessert when I'm having one?
Yeah, people constantly offering you cake and sending you photographs of chocolate. And it's like, no, please support me for what I need to do for me.
Yeah. Totally. And then, of course, you know, the big one is the topic of sex, you know, and you mentioned that, you know, for you that because of trauma, you weren't, you know, sex was difficult without, you know, alcohol or whatever. And I think for many people who have stopped drinking, it can come as a hell of a shock that actually when you stop drinking, it literally can be the first time you have ever had sex sober. I mean, what a sobering thought that is. You know, when it dawned on me, oh my God, I mean, if you started drinking when you were a teenager, you may never have had sex sober. So no wonder it comes as a hell of a shock. It's very different.
So what
do you recommend?
I mean, look, there's a lot of issues there. Trauma, yes, but also body confidence.
Yes.
Because, you know, traditionally alcohol is like, oh, you lose your inhibitions, right? Have a drink and it will be fine. And there are some people who just start off from that place.
Yeah.
And then it becomes something of a habit, you know? Now, the other thing is that because the alcohol, you know, numbs you a little. You don't feel the same feelings.
Yeah.
You're actually not having good quality sex when you are constantly having drunk sex. And what we also have to question is the motivations for having sex in those moments. Because, you know this better than I, but when you are drinking, what happens is all kinds of ideas come into your mind, all kinds of thoughts pop up in that mind of yours. And the deep, dark part of yourself that's motivated to seek validation and approval or to, seek some kind of attention pops up to the forefront. And then that can manifest in this kind of, sex that isn't grounded in authenticity and connection, but is all about something else.
Yeah.
You know, so there are lots of issues there with the sex. But for somebody who has stopped drinking and who is starting to feel again, well, it's about asking yourself, isn't it? Well, what are my needs? What are my desires sexually? What makes me feel really, really good?
Mm.
What kind of sex would I like to be having? And what part of me would I like to be expressing? And to do a little bit of self-inquiry around that. And I often suggest that people start off with the self-love part, getting to know and love and like their bodies, and really getting in touch with fantasy and desire. I mean, this is the sex therapist in me speaking now, right? So that actually you start to see that sex is something that you want for yourself on your own terms, as and when you want it. And you get to a place where you invite that from your space of clarity and centeredness, and then it changes. It becomes something else entirely. And of course, with the alcohol in the mix, it's a bit like two bodies are coming together, but you're not really present. And, it's all a bit sort of messy and fumbled. And then, the next day, you don't feel that sense of having deeply bonded with a partner. Now that you are clear, you can actually really start to have fun with the sex. You're going to have more energy. You're going to have much more clarity. You're going to feel much more present with your partner. And then that bonding is going to really stand you in good stead, like, the glue in a relationship, if you like.
I think you're so right, though, that the starting point there has to be that self-love, because to be able to even begin to have that kind of body confidence, or even to be able to communicate like that, or set those kind of boundaries, and I mean, even to be able to do that, you need to feel kind of grounded and to know who you are. There needs to be that kind of authenticity that I know for me, I didn't have that when I was drinking.
No.
No wonder I didn't. I talk all the time about the fact that, I couldn't meditate despite talking about it. I couldn't do it because I couldn't be with myself.
Yes.
So I also couldn't possibly feel confident enough to express what I need, because I didn't feel solid in who I was,
Yeah.
So I think it does. It all comes back to this self-love and as that kind of foundation, doesn't it?
It really does. And I just want to say that, this is not an overnight thing.
No, exactly. I suppose that's what I'm trying to say in a way. Yeah, it doesn't happen instantly.
It's not. And it's about really asking yourself, well, what do I want? What do I truly want?
And by the way, that's not selfish, is it? That's just showing up.
No. It's really about that. There are two ways I try and explain it. There's selfishness, which is, we know what selfishness is. It's stealing something that isn't really ours to steal, I suppose. Selfishness. That's how we feel. But then there's also this concept that I speak of, which is self-service. And it's a bit like you are in service to yourself. You see yourself as honourable, wise, lovable, just in the way that if you want to come at it from a spiritual perspective, you might see a god or a goddess. You know, see that divineness, see that special part of you, that essence of you, and honor it by being in service to yourself. You know, and that's a completely different thing. And so taking your time to ask yourself, what do I really, really want and how can I get there, is an act of sovereignty and self-service, not of selfishness.
Yeah. And I suppose from that, you know, from that sort of position, you are much more open to what others want and need as well. So it isn't all just gimme, gimme. Because you become more compassionate and kinder, I think.
Yes, it's so true. And, you know, it's about the baby steps. When you know what you want, you can take the baby steps to get there because you are completely focused on that goal. And of course, it's never linear. It's always, you know, a bit of a messy journey.
Yeah.
However, you know what you want. And so that's where you're going. And this kind of work isn't something that we just, you know, do overnight. We don't wave a magic wand and say all of a sudden, you know, I'm sober now, I'm clear now, I'm connected now. And so all of a sudden, I'm going to be able to jump into bed and have good sex. It's really an incremental process where we have to really work with ourselves gently, particularly if there has been trauma, because we don't want to re-traumatize anybody.
Yeah.
But I promise you that over time, and I'm not going to give you a time frame because we're all so different, but over time, we can all get there. And I mean, I feel like, you know, for myself, I'm 47 years old now, and I can say that I've got to that place. And who says sex is only for the under 20s, you know, or the under 30s or whatever? I know I've got a daughter who's nearly 17, and she thinks sex for anybody under 21 is fine. Anybody over 21
exactly.
Is disgusting.
You know?
So you know what I'm saying, though.
Yeah, it's definitely.
It's never too late for that.
Yeah. Let me ask you about people who, because again, you know, sometimes people have a single, but you know, and they're in the process of finding a new partner, attracting a new partner, but because there has been trauma in the past, or because they have had a really toxic, in inverted commas, relationship, and really awful stuff going on, they're really nervous of how the next one will go. So they're sort of nervous of, well, what am I suppose it's the baggage, isn't it? What's the baggage I'm bringing with me? And how do I stop myself from allowing what happened before to affect this new relationship?
Well, firstly, I would say choose carefully, because we are, as human beings, prone to being, creatures of habit,
repeat the patterns.
Choose carefully. Have your set of non-negotiables when you're seeking a new partner, and be very clear. There is no rush, you know. Be very clear about whether this person is somebody that you would like to move forward with. Now, society suggests, movies suggest, that things always have to go a certain way. In real life, they don't. Things go on your terms.
Yeah.
And so therefore, if you are a person who needs to move slowly, who needs to be really sure about somebody before you jump in, and also who needs to check out whether that person is really attuned to you, and by that I mean, does that person share your core values? Does that person seem to be headed in the same direction? Can you build a shared vision with this person? I mean, those are the questions you need to be asking in attuning to somebody. You know, maybe then it is time to dip your toe in the water with that person. And even then, it's about the boundaries and the self-reflection and having enough space to be able to come back to yourself regularly to check in with, am I in the right place for me? Is this the right relationship for me? Is this going in the right direction? Where am I compromising myself? And if so, where and how? And what do I need to do to set the course right?
And I guess it comes back to that communication piece as well, doesn't it? Because, you know, if you are nervous that you're going to, I don't know, bring old baggage with you, you know, perhaps some of that needs to be communicated rather than everyone trying to second guess what's going on when the other person's in a mood.
Yes. I mean, the thing is, it's always delicate, isn't it, to know whether you should be spewing out all your history.
Yes. On the first date.
But I always think, well, look, it's on a need to know basis. And I think one of the things about good communication is that it doesn't always have to be comfortable. To learn to be able to sit with discomfort is such a skill. And to be able to say to a partner or somebody that you're dating, there was a bit of a trigger for me yesterday or last night, and I want to just tell you what it is. Can we talk about it?
Yeah.
You know, that's an incredible relationship skill, because, you know, you are then also in a way testing to see whether the other person can enter into those important conversations and meet you where you need to be met.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just very briefly, changing the topic slightly to other relationship dynamics. You know, I know people who have really difficult situations with their own children, grown-up children, you know, situations where the grown-up children are, you know, sort of alienating them or not allowing them to see grandchildren, really hurtful things. Do you have any tips or advice for people in that kind of setting? Because, you know, it doesn't matter what age your kids are, they're always your kids, right? You always love them, but there can be real real toxic stuff going on there sometimes.
Yes, there can. And I always say that it doesn't really matter who the person is who may be abusing you. Abuse is abuse, and toxicity is toxicity. And so we must all look after ourselves first, however painful that is, and whether it is one's son or daughter or whatever. The important thing is to put yourself first. Now, quite often, adult children who are in that position are in that position because maybe they have some childhood issues that they are working with. They don't even know they're working with, but they're working with them, right? And so it can be useful to set up a dialogue with them, with perhaps a family therapist, for example, if you want to go down that route. But if not, it's important to recognize what the dynamic is between you and the other person, and to be able to invite them to talk about that if you want to solve it. I mean, I do know that there are many people who become estranged because of this. And sometimes it is the right thing to do, because, you know, narcissism and toxicity can be so deeply ingrained in individuals that this was always where their personality was headed.
Yeah.
And I've even spoken to some people who have said, you know, with my child, you know, even as a very small child, I could see that he had these tendencies, and I'm not quite sure where they came from. You know, I have heard people say that. So it's a case-by-case basis.
But what we can't do, I guess what you're saying is, you know, whether it's your child or not, you can't just be a punch bag for them.
No, you have to come first, and you have to ask yourself whether you have the resource to manage this relationship as it is, and to be able to put the issues on the table and to solve them, and whether you can actually assert your boundaries with this other person, whether it is the child or not, at the end of the day. And sometimes we do have to go no contact. Not always, but sometimes. And that's hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we could talk forever in a day, couldn't we? But I really appreciate it. I like your approach. It's, you know, well, it's very sensitive, isn't it? You're really sort of coming from that place of compassion. So just tell us where we can find out more about the work that you do.
Yes, so you can go to my website, riannekivitz.com, and there's also an ecstatic breath meditation in there as well for those who are interested in topics like manifestation and raising their vibrational frequency and all the spiritual stuff that we haven't really touched on this evening.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to have you back, definitely. Come on again, definitely.
Thank Brilliant. You.
Rhianne, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Rhianne. And we have some wonderful guests coming up on the podcast. I've had a chance to chat to some great people lately. I did a really lovely piece with psychologist Emma Kenny, all around happiness. She's doing something with the Marigold Happiness Survey. And there's some really cool little stats in there. So that was really good fun. I'm going to be interviewing someone who is an expert on perimenopause and menopause. So I don't know whether I'll bring you that on the podcast, but that interview will definitely be on UK Health Radio, on my UK Health Radio show. I've got a bunch of great guests lined up. And as always, if you know of anyone who would be a great fit for the podcast, please let me know. Even better if you can connect me, that would be amazing. Don't forget to check out the competitions that we have. We've got, as most of you know, I run the Platinum Awards, and it aims to promote all things natural and organic, and it would be great if you wanted to nominate favorite brands or have a look at some of our blog posts. Most of it is on imperfectlynatural.com, but it absolutely relates with the Alcohol Free Life podcast too. We've got a category for alcohol free drinks, and so we have some competitions to give some drinks away. I think we've still got one live for Naughty AF. We've got a competition to win the Jomo Club's subscription box. They were my guests last week. That's a really fantastic prize worth over 150 quid, I think. There's an opportunity to win some Sea Arch. I think that competition is still live. So there's lots of stuff there. You know, you've got to be in it to win it, as they say. So that's at imperfectlynatural.com. And everything else is at thesoberclub.com. And I will see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.